Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silicast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, June 22nd, 2008, and this is show number 157. I am so hot. No, I don't mean I look good, although of course I do, but I'm referring to the temperature in Los Angeles this weekend. We're roasting alive. I live near the beach. I know, cue the sympathy music. But living there, we're used to what we call June gloom. For the entire month of June, every year, ever since I've lived here, our weather report goes like this. It's on a repeating loop. They do it every day. It goes like this. Early morning low clouds followed by hazy afternoon sunshine. Repeat. That's all we ever get. But for some reason, we don't have any fog at all. There's nothing. There's no overcast. There's no haze, no fog, no gentle sea breeze. We're just sitting here roasting. I mean, it was over 80 degrees in my house this morning at like 8 in the morning. And, oh, by the way, 80 degrees is 27 real degrees. I'm just dying here. There's no air conditioning because it never gets this hot. All right, well, let's just get on with the show and maybe I'll forget how uncomfortable I am. Forgive any bird sounds you hear from my open windows because I would boil alive in these headphones if I had the windows closed. Well, Jane from Perth sent in an audio recording about her new digital SLR purchase. I can't wait to hear how she got on with it.
Hi, Alison. It's Jane from Perth in Australia. I'd like to take you back over a couple of decades and relate a short tale to you. Picture this, as they say. The year is 1981. A young, very, very young woman spends hours reading photography magazines and catalogues and finally decides to buy an Olympus OM2N 35mm SLR camera. Yes, that's one that uses a roll of film. Digital cameras didn't exist then in those dark, distant days. For the next 20-something years, the camera serves its mistress faithfully, never putting a foot wrong, and producing its finest results at everything from mad parties, day trips, family events, to being a close travelling companion on distant excursions to far-flung continents. Over the years, the Olympus produced drawers full of photographs that eventually found their way into boxes at the back of cupboards. Over time, technology moved on, and digital cameras started to appear on the scene. The, by now slightly older woman, saw the merits of these new-fangled devices. Ah, no more developing costs or storage nightmares and instant gratification upon seeing the result of that shutter release. And so it was that at the beginning of an expedition to various parts of Australia in 2002, the trusty 35mm Olympus was left at home on its 21st birthday, and a small 2.1-megapixel digital camera was purchased. Oh, the joy of snapping away and not worrying about running out of film was fantastic. Times had indeed changed. But along with the purchase of that point-and-shoot digital camera came a time of photographic wilderness, where, instead of looking for artful shots and choosing appropriate f-stops, the camera just took quick snaps. This lack of photographic interest was countered by the lightweight and compact virtues of the small digital device, not to mention the lack of boxes and boxes of prints. Life became too hectic for multiple lenses, decisions about ISO 100 versus ISO 400 and developing costs. As megapixels grew and camera sizes shrank, an even smaller point-and-shoot camera was purchased, this time with a whopping 6 megapixels. Photo quality improved, but lack of a viewfinder was a huge mistake. By now there were a myriad of photo blogs appearing on the magical interweb. Digital SLRs were being discussed on podcasts, and the Flickr website was taking the internet by storm. The time had come to return to the real world of modern digital photography, and the now middle-aged woman set about reading not magazines as she had done some 27 years ago, but websites about the pros and cons of the multitude of digital SLR cameras available today. After months of endless changes of mind between Nikon versus Canon, a decision was made. Yes, it was to be the Canon 450D, also known as the XSI, a model announced in January this year, and it finally became available in Perth in June. Well, what a coincidence. There just happened to be a birthday in June. A pleading voice was heard to say, "Oh, husbandly one, I think I know what I would like for my birthday present, pretty please." There dawned a new era in the woman's technology life as she took possession, not 3 days ago, of a wonderful piece of 12-megapixel digital technology and embarked on a renewed acquaintance with all things photographic. Right, back to playing with my new toy now. Oh no, it's time for me to go to work. See you later, everyone.
Oh, Jane, you are such a tease. I can't believe you ended it like that. Well, what happened next?
You darn well better come back with an update after you've actually taken some pictures with the new camera. That was just mean. Well, I have one more story left from D6, and don't worry, it's not another name-dropping story, I promise. They have kind of a small exhibit floor at D6, maybe like 15 or 20 vendors at most, and this year they had Steelcase, the people who make desks. They've come out with a really cool desk that I want. It's called the Walkstation. It's a treadmill combined with a desk. I know that sounds nutty, but it's actually pretty cool. The treadmill doesn't go faster than about 2 miles an hour. That's 3.2 kilometers per hour in real units. So they keep it that slow so you can't hurt yourself, because you can't really type or do anything efficient going slower or going any faster than that. They had it set up so you could test it out, and I was able to type pretty comfortably while walking at maybe a mile and a half an hour. The woman from Steelcase said they've tracked people and companies on this contraption, and they tend to walk an average of 2 hours a day. Imagine how much better you'd feel if you had a two-hour walk every day instead of a two-hour butt-numbing chair sit. You know, I used to have a job where I ran around a lot, building to building, running down the hall to ask people stuff, and now I pretty much just sit in my chair all day long. I'm getting worried that my butt is going to take on the shape of my chair pretty soon. I would love to have one of these walk stations. Or better yet, their new sit-to-walk station. The sit version has a bit more practicality because you can alternate between sitting and walking. I'm not sure how you work on your computer when you get tired of walking with the walk station. Well, I know I'd never be able to talk my company into the expense. I think it was like $7,000 or $4,000, I forget. But it had a lot of zeros in it for a desk. But if I were independently wealthy and I had my own home business, I would so put one of these things in my office. I'm not sure it's for everyone, but I would like it. I've always thought it would be a good idea to put a recumbent bike as a chair for all computers, and the pedaling actually powers the machine. See, but better yet, the faster you pedal, the faster your processor would go. Wouldn't that be great? So then, like, the really killer gamers would be thin instead of fat? It'd be awesome. All right, so this was a completely impractical tip for everybody, but I liked it. I put a link in the show notes to details.worktools.com where you can see the walk station yourself. Have I ever mentioned to you before that Honda Bob is a geek? Did I mention that? Well, today he stopped by my house to show off his latest gadget, the MyView. The MyView pipes video from your portable media device, like, say, an iPod, onto a virtual screen in a pair of Jordy LaForge-type glasses. This is one of those classic promises of the future, goggles to watch big screen TV. The MyView he bought is called the MyView Crystal. And by the way, that's spelled M-Y-V-U. He bought the MyView Crystal, which lists for about $300. He let me test it out. He plugged it into his video iPod and into the MyView and then turned on I Am Legend on his iPod. And I saw a really nice display, and he had the sound from the headphones that sort of dangle from the earpieces so they're easy to just lift up and pop into your ear. So the idea is, if I haven't explained this very well, is it's basically like a pair of goggles that are projecting inside it a virtual image that feels like it's about 20 feet away with the video playing on it. The MyView is a bit heavy to wear standing straight up, kind of feels like it's going to fall forward off your nose, but reclining a little bit, it's really comfortable. I got a picture of Honda Bob wearing his MyViews and holding up his iPod with video with his new turquoise blue plastic case. It's a classic photo. He looks fantastic. Anyway, I put a link to it in the show notes, along with a link to the MyView at Amazon, where they're selling it for $218 for the crystal version that Bob got. Well, remember that part where I make a little coin if you buy from one of these click-throughs to Amazon to learn about these toys I'm always talking about? Well, I found out from Jeff Miller that if you click on one of the Amazon links and then you buy something else on Amazon, I still get a small percentage of the sales. Now, remember, I would have put in a photo and a link from Amazon anyway. That's what I always was doing. This is just easier, and I might get a little funding for the show. So click away. The MyView is available in less expensive versions as well, but I'm not sure what the differences are. If you're interested, there's a page comparing the models over on the MyView website at myvu.com. I'm not sure this is something for everyone, but it is sure cool from a geek perspective. Kind of makes you think about what the future is really going to be. One problem Honda Bob had was that he wears glasses, and since the virtual image is 20 feet away, he had trouble focusing. So he ordered a little attachment that will let him use it with his glasses. He also bought the carrying case for $15, which is really nice. Holds a USB cable separate with along with the charger for the glasses, and he's got the remote control and then the glasses themselves. If you want your Honda or Acura serviced by a genuine geek who speaks your language and also who will drive to your home in Los Angeles and Orange County areas, give him a call at 562-531-2321 or shoot him an email at hdabob@aol.com. HDA Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, or Honda Worldwide. All right, guess what? I lied to you again. You know what a liar I am. I have another thing I learned at D6 that I forgot to tell you about. All right, I'm going to try to construct a problem to be solved first. Let's say you have a computer at home, a computer at work, a smartphone, like an iPhone, for example, and it's a real pain to keep all those environments the same, all those different operating systems. You got things going on in everyone differently. What if your entire operating system were actually in the cloud, in the internet? Not just an application here and there like Google Docs, but your entire operating system. What if you could get to a desktop environment from any of your devices where you had your photos, documents, music, even your desktop background set the way you like it? That might be kind of cool. What if you could edit a photo on the site using your PC, and when you looked at it on your iPhone, it was edited? What if you mess with the image on your Windows mobile device and the image was changed when you looked at it on your Mac? That would be kind of interesting, wouldn't it? Well, enter two solutions, Glide and Ghost. And I'm going to spell Ghost once, but it's going to come up a lot, G.H.O.S.T. Both of these services give you an entire desktop environment in the cloud. They do it with two very different approaches. Ghost is open source, and everything inside of it is open source. The Glide folks took a much different approach. They built all of their own tools and integrated them together. I thought it would be interesting to check out both of these to see which approach worked better for me, and if either of them really does solve the problem I described. Ghost uses completely open source tools, like I said, to create this virtual computer. Ghost pops up a full screen browser window and then launches Flash. When you create an account, you get 5 GB of free file storage and 3 GB of emails beyond that. Pretty impressive by itself. But if you get someone else to sign up, you get an extra gigabyte. I know this is silly, but I like the fact that they also have a little ghost that runs back and forth while I was waiting for my account to clear. I'm a sucker for a cool icon. Well, after my account was set up, I was faced with what looked to be like a very normal-looking desktop environment. I had a recycle bin, a sticky note, a clock widget, Yahoo News coming up in a live ticker, plus some other desktop items. Ghost is open source, like I said, and uses all open source tools. So if you want to run Office applications, they have Zoho Office pre-installed. I'd heard of Zoho Office before, but I'd never used it before, and I thought this would be a great opportunity to get some new views on things like this. Well, luckily for me, there was also a menu of options on the desktop called I'm a newbie to Ghost, and I want to... And under that, I had an option to upload files. So I decided to upload a couple of photos. Started out fine, showing me a progress bar, but I clicked away from the window, and when I came back, it had stopped at 90%. Well, I started the same two photos again and didn't change the focus, and they still stopped at 90%. I even tried doing just one photo, but it still got stuck at 90%. I checked the My Photos directory just in case they were uploading after all, and it knew there were photos, but there was nothing in there. I went to the Ghost Drive Explorer, and there was a search field, so I searched on a term in one of the photo names, and it found both of my photos. Unfortunately, when I clicked on them, it didn't show me a path of where it had put the photos, so I couldn't actually find them. Well, once I found the photo, I double-clicked on it, and it offered to open it in the Image Viewer, or Ghost Browser. In the Image Viewer, it was at full resolution, so the image was huge, and I couldn't find any controls to change the zoom or do anything to the image. I tried opening it in the browser, and at least in there it looked good, though I still couldn't do anything with it. Well, time to try out Zoho. I decided to start with spreadsheets like any good Excel savant would. I entered some text and some numbers. It was a bit slow because it was flash, but it worked okay. And I even did a few simple calculations. I did some formatting, but it didn't actually do it right. I put a box around three cells, and it kind of failed on two of the edges, so that didn't quite work. Formatting other things worked just fine. Bold, centered, right, justified, things like that worked okay. I tried to save the file by clicking on the disk icon, and nothing happened. Then I noticed another menu pick with tons of options. Save as Excel, Open Document, Open Office, Numeric Spreadsheet, many things I haven't even ever heard of before in that list. I thought it would save inside Ghost, but it didn't. It saved it to my Mac's hard drive instead, which was not what I was trying to do. I decided at that point to try bringing up Ghost on my iPhone, but of course the iPhone doesn't have Flash, so I couldn't access it at all. It's possible there was a mobile site, but I don't know what it would have been, especially with a name like g.ho.st, I wasn't sure where to go. Well, Ghost is a cool idea, but the performance was pretty annoying. Windows wouldn't pop to the front when clicked, and some wouldn't close properly at all, and moving Windows around had a lot of delay and not very smooth movement. I like where they're going with Ghost, and I like that they're using open source tools, and I'll be keeping an eye on them for now, but it was just too hinky. Too many things just didn't work. Well, the other contender in this space, as a marketeer would say, is called Glide at glideos.com. The folks at Glide took a completely different approach. They developed all of their own applications. They have their own photo editing software, their own calendar, word processing spreadsheets, and other applications. When you first open Glide, you have a nice-looking desktop with icons for the tools I just mentioned, along with some menu choices across the bottom for things like settings, address book, stickies, and more applications like a media player and calculator. I think the idea is that you can have applications on the desktop or along the bottom. I'm not really sure because I couldn't see a distinction between the two types of applications. The promise of Glide isn't that you have everything in the cloud, but rather this cloud-based OS has all of the same information you have on your hard drive of your various computers. You can sync your address book, photos, calendars, bookmarks, and they're all kind of synced together in theory, I think. Well, in order to accomplish this, Glide has a desktop client that runs on Windows, Mac OS X, Linux, and Solaris. I thought that was pretty cool that they go that far. I was a little leery about this at first, but I decided to charge ahead and download and install the Glide desktop application on my Mac. I opened Glide on my desktop, and it offered to let me set my preferences to log into Glide OS automatically, which I did, and then I told it to log in. I was faced with a very nice-looking interface with different containers, like photos, address book, and other things. I asked it to upload my address book, and it automatically found the Apple address book, and in about 10 minutes, it had uploaded about 600 contacts. Why do I have so many people in my contacts? I don't know, 600 people? Oh, well. Anyway, I went over to glideos.com, and I clicked on the address book in the bottom tray, and there were all of my contacts in a beautiful little book, just like the old days of having a real address book, formatted beautifully with little tabs down both sides to choose which letter to jump to. I wish I could show you a screenshot of that in the show notes, but I'm just thinking my contacts may have an issue with me displaying their names, addresses, and phone numbers on the web. Well, anyway, next I tried photos. In Glide OS, you have three major tabs across the top. Desktop, which I've been talking about already, Glide HD, which I assume is Glide Hard Disk, and Portal. Glide HD is your virtual hard drive where photos, music, and other things can be uploaded. When I clicked on Upload Files, I was able to choose a couple of photos to upload. By the way, the same two I tried to upload to Ghost, and then they showed up on my Glide Hard Disk. Looked just fine. The interface here, again, is beautiful and pretty darn responsive considering this is all done in Flash too. None of the lag that I saw in Ghost. If I click on a photo, I can tag it, rate it with stars, look at the EXIF data, I can pay to have the photo printed, and I can edit the photo. If I choose to edit, it opens up in another browser window, which at first I thought was kind of annoying, but then I thought about it, it's sort of like launching an application. You might want to go back to your operating system and not have to kill the program. Photo editing, though, is pretty limited, not nearly as good as, say, Picnic or Photoshop Express, which are both web-based photo editing sites. I didn't like the response time of photo editing either, and the lack of visual feedback when you make menu selections. Oh well. Well, next I fooled around with email. You get a Glide free email account when you sign up. I opened up my Glide free account and composed an email. I clicked on the address book and searched for my own name. This is one downside. You do have to do it that way. It doesn't automatically search your address book when you type, or at least I didn't wait long enough for it to do it. And then when you do search in your address book, that search is pretty slow. And when I found two matches for my name, it didn't show me which address was which, because I have Allison Sheridan at two different addresses in my address book. So I had to blindly pick one. I attached a photo from my Glide HD and sent the email. When I received the email on my personal account, it had a link to the photo on the web instead of downloading it to me. I thought that was a really terrific choice. Why send these big photos around if you don't necessarily want to download them? How many times do you get images from people that you really don't want? You know, friends send you something with a bunch of pictures in it and you pay for the download time and the bandwidth and all that. But I thought it'd be nice for people, especially if they have slow connections, where they could choose to go click on the link or not. When you click on the link, you get a small thumbnail view, and then you can choose to download it. I thought that was really cool. Well, there's a ton more functionality in Glide, including community aspects like groups and online meetings, but I think I'll leave it up to you to investigate if you're intrigued enough. I talked to the Glide folks at the show, and the guy told me they've packaged this up so you actually could deploy it inside of a company. I thought this was intriguing because from an IT perspective, maybe it could give you a controlled environment for security reasons. He showed me how they'd built a system administration control panel where you could even track like where attachments had been shared. So you could see who had sent a certain attachment out and where they had gone if you needed to ever go back and look at that information. You could set privileges for sharing, like read-only versus read-write, all kinds of really cool admin stuff in the background. I tested out Glide on my iPhone, too, and it worked pretty darn well, in spite of the fact that the iPhone doesn't support Flash. Whatever they sent me to wasn't Flash. The one thing that I do find confusing about the entire Glide service is that they have all these different URLs they use. There's the place you sign up, which is GlideDigital.com. The iPhone has to be pointed to GlideMobile.com. The operating system itself is at GlideOS.com. But if I go to my Glide hard disk, I'm at GlideSociety.com. And when I'm in my email, I'm at GlideFree.com. I mean, the list goes on and on. I found myself very confused in how to keep track. It would have made more sense to me to pick one domain and just prepend or append the details to that. Like GlideOS.com, let's say that's the main one. Then you'd have like m.glideos.com for the mobile version, mail.glideos.com for email. See where I'm going here? There'd be a pattern. You could figure it out. This is workable, but I didn't think it had to be this confusing. It was hard for me to figure out where to go on my iPhone. The bottom line is between Ghost and Glide, if I was looking for a virtual operating system today, I'd have to give a significant edge to Glide for a much more polished environment, with tools that worked predictably and smoothly, versus Ghost, which was kind of hinky and jerky and a lot of stuff didn't work. It hurt me not to give the edge to the open source solution, but Glide is much closer for prime time. Like Ghost, Glide is also free with 5 gigabytes of storage and 5 users. For $4.95 a month, you can get 15 gig and 25 users, and you can add 15 gig of storage per month for another $4.95 per month. If you want a yearly plan, you can pay about $50 per year for the 15 gig for up to 25 users, which saves you about 2 months of payments. Check it out at GlideDigital.com. Time for another exciting episode of Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchatz from bartbouchatz.ie/blog. What's it like out there in Ireland today, Bart?
It's bucketing rain, and it has been since about 5 o'clock yesterday evening.
Oh, you know what? I think I would like rain right now. It's 79 degrees in my room where I'm recording right now, and it's only 10 in the morning. 79, what did I tell you that was? Like 27 degrees C?
Too much for 10 o'clock in the morning, because it ain't going to get any cooler as the day goes on, is it?
No, we were going to go to the beach, but our run on the beach this morning was sweltering. I mean, it was 75 degrees. We got up early. I got up at 6:30 so I could be on the beach by 7, and it was already 75 degrees on the beach. It was horrible.
Yikes. Do you not have air conditioning in your room?
No, we don't have air conditioning because it's never this hot. I mean, it's, you know, 79 degrees is not that hot. Yeah, but not by the beach. When you live by the beach, the ocean breeze comes in. And actually, our June forecast has always been, for the last 25 years, Early morning low clouds followed by hazy afternoon sunshine. That's the weather report. That's all they need
copy,
to
paste,
say.
Copy, paste, copy, paste every day.
Right, coda. And it's always been that way, but for some reason, there's no hazy early morning low clouds, and there's no hazy afternoon sunshine. We're just sitting in blazing heat. I'm just glad I don't live in the valley. So it was 109 there yesterday.
That's warmer than body temperature. How does that not kill you?
Well, that's like 10 degrees warmer than body temperature. I think you're inside in air conditioning, so we're thinking of going to the movies today instead of doing anything productive because it's air conditioned there.
Well, yeah, every mall will be air conditioned, so it'll be full of shoppers. All trying to escape the heat.
That's the one problem. Well, hey, we actually had a technical topic to talk about today. I think we were going to talk about Firefox 3.
Yeah, those nice fellows who managed to DDoS themselves. That was very funny.
The denial of service attack they caused them themselves by trying to do a world record?
Yeah, it was a pure PR stunt from what I can gather, because apparently there was no pre-existing record, and they just decided to make one.
Well, that's kind of fun. I heard they actually did submit it to the Guinness Book.
Yeah, they're waiting for the official word back from the Guinness people. And what the official record will be. Apparently it's 1.8 million or something, is what I've heard. I don't know if that's true, but we'll find out soon enough.
Wait, I thought it was 8 million.
Oh, maybe. Well, I was going by cranky geeks who were...
It can't be 8 million. It's got to be 1.8. You're probably right.
That's what your man Rupley said on Cranky Geeks.
Oh, so okay.
I believe. He's usually intelligent.
Yeah, I like
so cranky.
So what do you think of Firefox 3?
It's pretty damn good, all in all, I have to say. I have to say, though, I was on Twitter while, the thing came out, and, we're all going, are you going to download Firefox 3? And I was like, wow, the Firefox site hasn't fallen over. Oh, wait, it has. Oh, no, it's back. Oh, wait, it's gone. It's on for hours. It took me 3 hours to get it, but I got it in the end. No, it's a big step forward from Firefox 2, without a shadow of a doubt. I suppose for a long time, Firefox has been a great browser for donkey's years, even before it was called Firefox. I remember when it was called Firebird, and I used to love it then. I think it was 0.7, I think, is the first time I started using it around about then. And it was already the best browser around. And the 1.0 release was considered by everyone to be a big step. And then the 2.0 release was considered by everyone to be a giant improvement. And now the 3.0 release is another really big step forward. But a flaw that it's had for a very, very long time has been that it leaks memory like a sieve. I mean, I think it could probably sail an oil tanker through some of those memory leaks. It was always fun on the activity monitor to have a look at how much virtual memory Firefox was using, and it was usually in the gigabytes. So you open a few tabs, you close them, and they don't give back all of their RAM. And so after you've had about 50 tabs open, you end up with a problem.
Oh, maybe that's been my trouble, because I have a habit of never closing any tabs anyway and opening 7 or 8 browser windows in the same browser with 15 things in each one.
Yeah, that'll do it. So that memory leak, it's been known about for a long time, and they've really been quite poor about plugging it. So they made a big deal out of the fact that for 3.0, they really were going to go right down into the bowels of the code, where they probably haven't been in a long time, and really plug all those low-level problems. And I think they've succeeded. It certainly feels as if they have. It feels snappier and doesn't seem to be taking up quite as big of a footprint. Then the other thing about it is that it's always looked like an oddball. On Windows, people are used to different programs looking completely different to each other. But on the Mac, we're not. We're a little spoilt in the fact that we expect all of our applications to look like Mac applications. And Firefox has just always stood out a bit because it's never had a Mac look.
Well, I got to say, one thing that does bug me about the Mac now is that every window has the exact same brushed chrome sort of look to it. Is now I can't tell which one's my mail and which one's iTunes and which one's a Finder window. Now I can't tell which one's Firefox. At least I used to be able to tell it apart.
It does look exceptionally Safari-like, I guess, although it has the big fancy bubbly back and forward buttons that are different sizes. I guess it's considered artistic. I'm not entirely sure. I'm a gigantic fan. But I actually like the fact that on the Mac, all the UI elements look the same. It gives you a real feeling of consistency. You feel right at home. And anything you learn in one program carries through to other programs.
Oh, that I absolutely agree with. And I never really understood why that was such a big deal with Apple until I started using Windows, where some applications, when you close them, they're actually quit. And some you close them, they're not.
Oh, I hate that.
That's insanity. Why would you do that? I've quit my, in particular, chat applications, and I find out later on people are still trying to chat to me, and it's and I can't see them, and they're complaining that I'm not answering. But I thought I closed it.
Yeah, and the dock, there are many things can be said against the dock, but it's pretty clear what is and isn't running in the dock.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
So they've really gone out of their way to make Firefox look OS X. Now, they haven't done what I really wish they would. It's not Cocoa. It's faux Cocoa. So they have replicated Cocoa rather than implementing Cocoa.
Now, for the non-developers in the crowd like me, what do you mean by Cocoa and not Cocoa and fake Cocoa?
Fake Cocoa. Okay, so the reason all the applications on the Mac look the same is because all of the ones that do look the same are written using the same APIs that Apple have given us, and those APIs are collectively called Cocoa by Apple.
And so APIs are Application Programmable Interface?
Basically, rather than reinventing the wheel, you simply say, give me one of those Apple buttons, please. And the operating system goes, okay, here you go, have one of those buttons. And it's the exact same button. So it's the same code whether you're in iChat or whether you're in, I don't know, iMovie or whatever. It's the same code generating those buttons. So they all look the same because they are the same. And they're all coming from Cocoa. Now, in the olden days, you had Carbon. So you'll have some older apps that use Carbon, and they don't look quite the same. But anyway, if apps use Cocoa, then stuff like Text Expander and all of those things that you get for free with Cocoa would work in them. So your OS X-based spell checker, Text Expander, all that kind of stuff just works with all Cocoa apps. And Firefox is not Cocoa. Hmm. So they've simply made it look like Cocoa, which means it looks at home, but it isn't. It still isn't quite at home, which is a pity.
Oh, that explains something. I've got in Rapido Write, I have a little keystroke thing that I do. I type CCA and I hit a carriage return and I get chit chat across the pond. And I tried doing it in Firefox yesterday and it didn't work.
And that's why.
Oh.
All of these things tie into the Cocoa APIs. So if your program doesn't use Cocoa, it doesn't get those features. Yeah. It's the reason Mozilla don't is because they're trying to keep their code base the same cross-platform, and Cocoa is an OS X platform.
Hmm.
So they're trying to keep the code base as similar as possible on Linux, Unix, and Mac, and hence they don't do Cocoa.
I guess there's
so what they've basically done is they've created a skin for Firefox, which looks like OS X.
Hmm.
But anyway, I still think it's a good improvement. It's faux Cocoa, so it's only halfway, but it's still a big improvement over not looking anything like Cocoa.
Yeah, that's good.
It's a step forward.
Okay.
Then I think we both agree on all this stuff so far, but I think we're then coming into our first disagreement.
And people love it when we disagree, Bart, so enough of the love.
Yeah. Well, I suppose the first thing is that the address bar now behaves very, very much like Quick Look. So as you start typing, in the past it would autocomplete a URL, but you had to start at the start of the URL. Now it will search through the titles of pages, it will search through the titles of bookmarks that match whatever you're typing, and it will just, you know, as you type more, it will condense down the results. And so as you begin to type, say if I type Podfeet, I'll see the logo, I'll see all that kind of stuff, and the URL and the title of the page coming up, and I can scroll down through, and so
and
I see that NoSellaCast has come up under Pod. Whereas if I'd start typing NOS, I'm sure it would come up too. Oops, not NOX. NOS, it comes up straight away, even though NoSellaCast is nowhere in the actual URL. It's only in the page title.
That's excellent. I didn't know that. Okay, I'm not arguing with you yet. That's fantastic.
Yeah. The bit you're going to argue with me on is that you are in the habit in Safari of clicking on the favicon to select the URL.
Right, so you don't have to click and drag to select it to erase it and replace it with something else. Perfectly reasonable thing to do.
Yeah, I'm in the habit of double-clicking on URLs, which is why this doesn't bother me at all, but the Firefox people have changed what it means to click on a favicon. And what it does now is it gives you security information on the page. And it gives it to you in a very Englishy and very sensible way. And that's a good thing. So if you go to www.paypal.com, which I believe... I probably should have brought this page up before we started recording because my internets are now completely consumed with Skype. But anyway, if you go to a URL that has proper security set up, if you click on that favicon, you will get all the information about that security cert and it'll be presented in a nice and simple way. And because PayPal, the example I've chosen, does something called extended validation, it shows up with a reassuring green bar that tells me that the website is owned by PayPal Inc. in the United States.
Actually, yeah, I just did that. That looks fantastic.
Verified by VeriSign Inc. I click on it. It gives me the nice little green passport-looking dude. It says I'm connected to PayPal.com, which is run by PayPal Inc. in San Jose, California, United States, verified by VeriSign Inc. Your connection to this site is encrypted to prevent eavesdropping. And if I click on more information, I get even more. I get the old-fashioned, highly unintelligible information, which is what you used to only get on all other browsers, where it tells you that, the chain of certificates and all this kind of stuff that no one cares about. But this way, they have given us a nice, easy way to get the information on a site we're at. Now, this whole green thing is called extended validation, EV. It's a big deal, to be honest, in terms of security. And it's something which Internet Explorer 7 does, and Firefox 3 does, and Safari lets itself down big time by not supporting.
Okay, let me back you up. I'm not against the idea of being able to show that it's secure and it says it's green and that sort of thing. That's pretty cool, and being able to see what the security certification is, so that if you are dumb enough to click a link in an email that says PayPal and that little sucker doesn't turn green, you should be paying attention to that. And I think as we get used to it, I think that'll be real good. But the problem that I have is this idea of selecting the URL. You just said you're used to double clicking it. Double click
it
right now.
Yeah, that's what I've always done.
Yeah, but double click that URL. It doesn't work. It only selects part of it.
Triple click.
It's actually single click.
Okay, triple click works too, though.
Okay.
Because it's the standard. Well, no, it's single click is to put your cursor in. If you think about any text in a word processor, single click is put your cursor in, double click is select a word, and triple click is select a line. Try it anywhere.
But that's not the way it works, Bart. That's my whole point, is when you single click, it doesn't insert your cursor into the text. It selects it. That's non-standard. Click away and then click once into it. So it's non-standard. And you have to click a second time in order to get to insert text, and three times to get what you want.
Yeah, well, I've always triple-clicked. So actually, I hadn't noticed that it changes behavior, because triple-clicking is just what I do by instinct. I can replace my triple-click with a single-click. And you can replace your clicking on the favicon with clicking on the URL.
Right. And then I bring up Safari and I get an insert. So I get two different UIs, which is exactly what you were saying. One of the great things about Mac applications is the UI is the same and the UI is different now. Makes me crazy.
Then triple-click, because that will work everywhere.
Okay, so then I triple my carpal tunnel syndrome. I don't want to do that either.
I've been triple-clicking for years because it's always worked everywhere. It's interesting. It never actually occurred to me. And I'm pretty sure that there's quite a bit of sort of fighting on the blogosphere about whether or not this is a good or a bad thing. I don't think it's one we're going to settle here. But yeah, I guess some people are going to be annoyed by that. I'm not sure how big a deal of it is to some people, and I guess that's up to everyone to decide.
Yeah, I guess if I saw great value in the certificates, that would be one thing. But I can't tell you how many times I go to a place where I know it's the real place and it tells me the certificate has expired. Now, I know that's bad on their part and they shouldn't have done that, but I get it all the time. I get it as often as I get a good certificate.
Okay, then you're dealing with amateurs. Wherever you're going to, really, they should fire their sysadmins. The thing which we haven't mentioned is what this whole EV certificate thing is, because it's not the same as a standard cert. It's massively different in a very important way. All a standard cert, people are used to saying, look for the lock icon and you're okay.
Right.
You'll hear people say that all the time. That's disastrously bad advice.
Oh, why?
Because all the lock icon means is that there is no one can eavesdrop on your conversation. It means that there's encryption from you to them. It says nothing about who they are.
Okay.
So it just says that there's no man-in-the-middle attack going on. But if you've connected to a hacker site or the site of some scammer or some phishing site, you are securely communicating with the bad guys. And the padlock will show up because you are securely communicating.
Okay.
Okay, so all it tells you is that there's no one eavesdropping. It does not tell you who the endpoint is. And the reason for that is that anyone can get an SSL cert. I mean, you've probably done it on GoDaddy. You click a few buttons, you pay $25 or so, and you have a cert. And all that cert says is that the server I'm talking to matches the URL of the cert. So if I go to paypal.com hackers.com instead of paypal.com, and I don't notice, if the cert is for paypal.hackers.com and the URL is paypal.hackers.com, the padlock will show up.
I see. Okay, so I guess I like the green thing. Okay.
Now, the green thing does something much different. So anyone can get an SSL cert. Okay, what the green thing is, there's a big formal standard been set out of what you have to do to get a green thing. And basically it involves you proving to VeriSign through jumping through a lot of hoops and paying a very significant amount of money that you are who you say you are. And they, you know, you have to send letters signed by all the members of the board and all sorts of stuff. I don't know the exact details, but basically there's a lot of hoops to jump through. And I think the guys over in Security Now did a whole podcast about this stuff. They have gone through a verification process, not just to verify that it belongs to the domain it says it belongs to, but to verify that the company which owns it is actually the company it says it is.
Oh, okay. That's
so when it says PayPal Inc. USA, you know that it has been verified by VeriSign that it really is PayPal Inc. you're dealing with.
Okay. How did they get their favicon so wide? Because it's got the PayPal symbol, the little favicon, but it also says PayPal Inc. Can I do that?
Okay, it's the PayPal Inc. isn't part of the favicon. That is the EV validation.
Oh, so I'd have to pay for that.
Oh yeah, a lot of money. We're talking thousands per year for EV.
It's cool looking though.
It's very cool looking, and it with good reason. It stands out very well as well. And I'm hoping we come to the point where everyone expects that. Any site that's looking for your credit card, or that's looking for bank details, or any financial information at all, if you don't see that green bar, right now, a lot of people don't have it yet, but a year from now, it should be so widespread that if you don't see it, you simply don't trust them. And if your bank doesn't have it, you should be contacting your bank and saying, why aren't you doing this to protect me?
My bank doesn't have it. I just checked.
Yeah, send them a letter. As I say, they're quite new, so give it a year. But right now, it's acceptable not to have it and even understandable. A year from now, I think pressure will be such that it simply won't be an option not to have it.
Okay, that sounds like good advice. Well, hey, speaking of security, I heard on Mac OS X that day one there was a security vulnerability found in Firefox 3.
Yeah, that's not particularly surprising. Browsers are always having security vulnerabilities found, and what's important with Firefox is not that they never have vulnerabilities, because they do. And they do, Safari does, QuickTime has a lot, IE does, they all do. What matters is how quickly they fix them, and Firefox's history on fixing is exceptionally good.
Yeah,
so I would expect very soon we'll have 3.1 or 3.0.1.
Yeah, they did have. They did mention it was a flaw in 2.0 also, but I think it was just unfortunate it got announced the day that Firefox came out. I don't know how they found their vulnerability. They had to have been able to download it to find it.
No, it's not unfortunate. What's gone on is that the researcher has found the vulnerability and has basically said, okay, I'm going to wait and see till 3 comes out and check that 3 has it before I announce.
Yeah, that's probably true.
And remember that the way Firefox works is their 3.0 version is identical to their last release candidate. Firefox 3 or C3 is the same as Firefox 3.0.
Oh, okay.
Always. So basically they keep doing release candidates until there are no problems. And then the final release candidate that didn't have any problems becomes the first release.
Okay, I see. Now, are there any big UI changes that you like? Or dislike?
What I really love, unbelievably love, is something that Safari's always done so well. When you click on a text field, you get that lovely blue glow around it. So it's really, really obvious which text field you're in. Firefox has that now. I think that's fantastic.
I'm not sure I follow you. What do you mean you click in a text field? Like if I'm on bertbouchats.ie/blog and I click in the search box and nothing, it didn't change.
Yeah, nothing happens because, okay, assuming that no one has applied any CSS to the text field to make it be whatever the CSS says, you will get that little glowy thing just like in Safari. Let me see if I can...
Oh, like Google, for example. If I go to Google. Okay. It's bright blue around it. I see what you're saying.
Yeah, Safari's always done that, and it makes it very obvious. So what I'm now going to do, because this is obviously very new, is I'm going to start stripping out CSS information from around my text fields all over the place so that they get that nice default look.
Okay. It looks like it also does a better job of highlighting things when you do a find on the browser. If you search for a word, it highlights it in a bright flaming green, and you can do a highlight all, and they all turn yellow.
Yeah,
that's kind of neat.
It's very like Safari. Very like Safari.
Yeah.
The find has always been very good in Firefox, but they've tweaked it just a little bit more.
Yeah,
because the highlight hole has always been there, but it's never been an obvious button. It was text that you had to click on.
I think it's. I still like the Firefox or the Safari one where it just. I mean, it's so obvious. It's a big, gigantic thing around the around the text you found.
Don't they actually magnify the results? Don't they?
I think so.
So they don't just highlight them; they actually zoom them out a little.
Yeah, and I think it kind of bulges at you, so you actually see it move, so it catches your eye. And the other thing is, it tells you how many it found. So right now, I'm testing it on a site here, and it seems to just show me that it's you can hit next and previous, but it doesn't tell me how many it found.
That's a very good point. There is room for improvement still. Yeah, okay. So that's
good though.
All pretty good. I mean, it's all improved. There's nothing about the UI that's disimproved. I haven't come across a single thing that I've gone, oh, that's a pity.
Now, one thing I think may have been there for a while, but I never noticed it, or maybe it's new. If you have a bunch of tabs open, on the right-hand side, there's a little tab symbol with a down arrow, and if you click that, you can see all the tabs you have open.
It was always there, but it was less obvious.
Yeah. Yeah, that's better.
It was a different icon. It was arrows instead of a little tab icon.
Right. Another thing I like is in the little Google toolbar in the upper right, which maybe it was always this way too, but I now see Google, Yahoo, Amazon, Answers, Creative Commons, eBay, and Wikipedia. Was that there before?
Always been there, along with the managed search engine button, so you could change the search engines as well.
Okay.
They've just made it more obvious.
Okay, but then, well, and again, that's good.
That's important. That's very important.
The autofill there, though, I mean, you start typing something in, it'll suggest searches.
Did that as well?
Did it really? I think it's doing it more. Oh, you know what? One of my problems is I've been using the release candidate, so it kind of crept up on me. I can't quite tell when things changed.
Yeah. I actually haven't, because I consider a browser to be so important I can't be over the broken one. So I've been avoiding the RCs until they went gold.
Well, you know me, I'm living on the edge at all times.
I like to live on the edge for some things, but I just can't afford to have browser problems, so I don't live on the edge with browsers, but I do with everything else.
I'll tell you one thing I didn't do. I had a chance to review, to do a beta test on a system-wide utility that changed your system preferences outside of the system preferences. Beta? Yeah, I ran away from that one. La, 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 la.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing where you want to make a complete image of your hard disk, do it, and then image it back.
Yeah, maybe. So if someone wanted to change to their default browser to Firefox, how would they go about doing that? Is that over in Safari still somewhere?
There's lots of places to do it now, including within Firefox. If you go to Firefox and Preferences, he says including within Firefox, but he may be wrong actually now that he mentions it.
I thought I looked there, but then again, I know it used to be in Safari. I couldn't find it there either.
Button somewhere. Within Safari, you can do it. Is it under General, under Advanced? Yeah, if you go to Firefox's Preferences and go to Advanced and then go to the General tab, the bottom is, you know, always check to see if Firefox is the default browser on startup, and then there's a button called Check Now.
But that's not what I want. I don't want it to keep checking. I want it to say
If you click the Check Now button,
right,
then it'll give you the option to do it.
Okay, but I don't want it checking all the time.
Okay, then uncheck the checkbox and you just click the button once.
Okay, they could have done that UI a little bit better.
Yeah, you can do it within Safari as well. Give me just 1 second. I'll fire up Safari here. It's interestingly
there it is. There it is. First thing on the general tab, default web browser.
Okay, there you go. Before we get all goody-goody and say that Firefox 3 is perfect, it has annoyed me a little in one regard. Well, every time Firefox upgrades, there's one thing that annoys people. It takes a while for the plugin developers to update their plugins.
Sure.
So for the first few days, you're going to lose a few plugins. And that may or may not be a showstopper. All the big ones are generally fine, so NoScript is perfectly fine. Flashblock as well. You will come across more obscure ones that won't be updated as quickly, and you may be without them for a few weeks. If that's a major issue, hold off on 2 for a while. The other thing is something which, as a photographer, I find particularly important. Many people won't care at all, right? But something that always annoys me is you spend ages in iPhoto tweaking your photographs until they're just right. You're messing with all the little sliders, and you get it till you're absolutely perfectly happy with it. You click export. You look at it in the Finder. It still looks perfect. You look at it in Preview. It still looks perfect. You stick it on the web. You open it in any browser other than Safari, and it looks terrible. And the reason for that is that, with the exception of Safari, none of the other major browsers do color space management properly. or they don't do it at all. So when you take a photograph with your digital camera, there's a color space inserted into the JPEG, which tells it how to display it. And if your browser doesn't support the color spaces, it will come out a little too bright, a little too dark. The color is a little bit off. It won't be perfect. Hmm. It will be more, depending on how much you've processed it, a lot or a little off. And Firefox always makes my pictures look too bright. So it always looks like I've slightly overexposed everything.
Hmm.
What's really annoying is that the Firefox guys have added support for color spaces into Firefox 3. And then proceeded to turn it off by default and not put an option in the preferences pane to turn it on. So it's in the code, and you can't get at it.
You can't do it? Oh, no.
But you can get at it, because there's a very little known thing. There's a whole load of hidden preferences in Firefox that most people are utterly unaware of. But if you type into the address bar, about:config, it shows all of the settings that Firefox supports, and there's loads of them. So it thankfully gives you a little search box to filter on, and if you find the right one, you can enable the color spaces. And I've included a link in my blog to a guy's instructions on exactly how you do this. And once you do that, the color space management is enabled, and all the photographs look perfect again, and it works. And I've been having it like that for a couple of days now, no major issues at all. So I don't understand whether it was an oversight or what it was, but they just didn't do it, and I don't know why.
You know, is there any way for you to capture on your screen the same photograph in two different, in Firefox and in Safari, and show the differences you're talking about? I mean, obviously, depending on what browser they show it on, it'll be brighter or not brighter, but at least the relative difference. Because I'm bringing up photographs of mine from Flickr in both browsers, and I can't see a difference at all.
Okay, it can be quite subtle, I have to say. And if you haven't done any processing, it's probably no difference at all. But if you start tweaking with the sliders and stuff in your photo editing, you will notice it. I'll see if I can dig up a link. There was one example I was using to test earlier in the week, because it was a photograph I was thinking of submitting to a group somewhere, and I fired it up in Firefox and said, "Oh God, I can't submit this. It looks terrible." And then I looked at it in Safari and I went, "Oh, I can submit this. It looks great." Oh, hang on. So I actually haven't submitted it yet.
Interesting. I am looking at photos I have not processed at all, and they look pretty stinking identical to me.
Okay.
Is it possible the monitor you're looking at maybe shows it more than I would on my MacBook Pro monitor?
MacBook Pro monitors, hang on, but you don't have the glossy monitor, so I'm not sure.
No.
I know for a fact that my MacBook Pro monitor is not perfectly calibrated, and I don't use it for really looking at photographs, because if you do a calibration test, the bottom two blacks look the same.
Okay.
Which they shouldn't. So my cinema display shows it really clearly.
Well,
that is a cinema display, and they're perfectly calibrated.
Yeah, that might actually be it, because I don't... I don't do any kind of calibration or anything like that. So is this only something, I don't want to sound snotty, but somebody really, really picky would notice?
Oh, yeah. This is one of those for people who are, it would go so far as to say, anally retentive about their photography.
I didn't want to say it. I thought I'd leave it up to you to say it.
But no, it's true. If you're really into photography and you have spent all that time tweaking it, it's annoying that it isn't displayed the way you've tweaked it, because you've spent time doing that.
Hmm.
So it's one where Safari still wins, and I don't understand why. And I'm really hoping that when Firefox 3.1, that they just enable it by default and be done with it.
Well, that sounds good. Now, there was one other thing we had talked briefly about before we started recording. Can you tell people about the ACID 3 test, or whatever they call it?
Yes. In the bad old days, and I'm sure, well, anyone who's unfortunate enough to have remembered web browsing in the days of Internet Explorer 3 and Netscape 3 is going to be all too well aware of this, but there was a time when there was no such thing as web standards, and there was actually, Internet Explorer were making up their own HTML tags, and Netscape were making up their own HTML tags, and trying to convince everyone that their special tags were better than the other one's special tags, and they were actually trying to sell the browser and how different it was. And this didn't work because users didn't care, and developers were driven potty by the fact that they had to do two versions of everything. It was hell. It was really, really bad. And so we're slowly beginning to move away from that mentality, Microsoft being the slowest to cop on, as per usual. So we now have official standards. The thing is, the official standards are very long, very complex, and very hard to implement perfectly. So although in theory we're all aiming for the same standards, all browsers don't quite achieve them all perfectly. In fact, no browser really achieves them absolutely perfectly. So you still end up with subtle little differences. So there was some guys decided to try to highlight the issue by creating, basically it's a little smiley face that's built up of lots of little different HTML elements positioned using CSS and stuff. And if your browser supports the standards, you see a smiley face. And if your browser doesn't, you see a great big mess.
Hmm.
And so that was the acid test. And that focused on some of the really important things, like the fact that Internet Explorer, for instance, utterly and completely ignored a gigantic, big, massive heading in the spec. And I'm not talking about a subtle little detail. I'm talking about something with a big, bright, bold, flashing neon light, auga kind of thing, you know? And they just completely rewrote the rules on that. And that drove people demented. It made all sorts of bizarre workarounds required. So the first acid test just tested for the really, really obvious stuff. And then, you know, as IE7 and all the different browsers got much better at dealing with these standards because they started, you know, bragging not about how different they were, but about how well they met the standards and the fact that they passed acid. And this was seen, you know, this was good to see that we're actually striving for standards compliance instead of striving to be different. Fantastic news for developers in particular. So then there was an Acid 2 brought out, which tested even more of the pernickety little detail. And now we're on to Acid 3, which gets into even more of the nitty-gritty. And the big thing is that IE8 apparently passes Acid 3 now, and so Firefox 3 passes Acid 3. And I think the latest developer seeds of Safari do as well. I'm not 100% sure on that.
Now, are there different levels of passing?
Oh, no. Either the smiley face shows up or it doesn't.
Oh, okay. I thought there's some percentage.
You either pass acid. Actually, apologies, you're right. The previous acids were just sort of binary. You either did or didn't render. But the Acid 3 now seems to have percentages because everyone is showing off the 100% Acid 3 logo, which the acid people have put out.
And who gets 100%? Firefox 3 does?
I thought it did.
Oh, okay.
Right.
No, I don't know.
Well, you brought it up, actually. I just sort of assumed they did. I really hope they did.
I thought Safari was something
really
like
71%. Yeah, has my mouse just run out of batteries? Oh, that's annoying. Well, yeah, my mouse has run out of batteries.
We can leave that to the student.
Okay, can you bring up the Acid 3 test and run it against Firefox?
And where would that be?
I have no idea. That's what Google is for.
Okay, let's see.
Okay, I'm doing it on the MacBook Pro now. I really hope I have more batteries in the house or it's going to be a very long day. Acid3test.org. Acid3.acidtests.org.
71 out of 100. So that's where I got the 71%.
Okay, that's a bit disappointing, actually.
The score has to end at 100 to 100.
71 out of 100, yeah. So who was it then? Someone got 100% recently. I think it might have been the IE8 people were bragging about that.
Ah.
Which is a great turnaround.
Okay, I just tried on Safari and it came up and said JS question mark? Oh, there it goes. Ooh, late test failed 51%. Oh, now it's up to 75 out of 100.
It's a 75 out of 100, but it seems to have failed on something major because it's put up a giant big...
nasty red cat.
Yeah, is it a cat?
Well, it's got whiskers.
Yeah, I think it's a cat. Okay.
I wonder if this makes good audio. What do you think?
I think it makes terrible audio, so we should probably stop. Anyway, Acid 2. Can we bring up Acid 2 here? If I just change the 3 to a 2, will that bring up Acid 2? Haha, it does.
So the Acid 2 test? Ooh, take the Acid 2 test. All I got was a weird smiley face. Kind of frightening looking smiley face.
Yeah. That's what you need to get. So it passes Acid 2 with flying colors.
Ah, okay, so maybe that's it. Well, it did it awfully quickly on both browsers. It just instantly did it.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. The old acid tests weren't a percentage thing. Either you got the smiley face or you didn't.
Okay.
So if you click on the button there and it says the reference rendering, if what you get from your browser looks identical to the reference rendering, then your browser passes Acid 2.
Okay.
If it doesn't, it doesn't. So, okay, so we're getting ahead of ourselves. After wasting a lot of time here. So it renders Acid 2 perfectly, but not Acid 3. Anyway.
Okay. So
how long have we? How long has our 15 minutes been?
35. So we're a little bit high on 15 minutes. So we probably have did a bunch on this. By the way, I just tested Flock on acid 3, and it got a 37 out of 100 with two nasty-looking red cats.
Oh, dear.
Oh, wait, it kept going. It's up to 52. It's still working on it. 52. Not very good.
Yeah, that's not good. That's very not good.
Well, I've learned more about this, and I appreciate the time you spent putting together some thoughts on this. This is pretty interesting.
Yeah. So hopefully in Firefox 3.1 or whatever, we'll see full acid 3 compliance. But the fact that it was acid 2 is a big thing. Acid, you know, if you're at acid 2, then you can already really start developing to the standards, and it should work fine on Firefox, which is really good for developers.
I really am looking forward to Internet Explorer 8 because it's going to break all those websites that use non-web standards, and everybody's crying and complaining and whining about that. But that's going to be awesome because they got to stop doing that.
Yeah, I think someone was saying that, I was reading an article today, in fact, that the new Mobile Me is not going to work in IE6. They are not supporting it.
Good.
Exactly. And people are saying, but, you know, all the corporate internet still have pages that require IE6. It's like, well,
stop
IE6
it.
Came out in 1996.
Oh, God, it was crappy 12 years
then.
Old?
Yeah. I think that's what it said.
It is the worst browser.
It's going by memory here. I could be wrong again. But it's old. It's been around for a long time. And it's rubbish. It's time it was gotten rid of.
Yeah, I think so. Even if you're not leaving XP, you can go to IE7 at least.
Yeah, and if you're not on XP yet, you have much bigger problems.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, because at this day and age, a lot of the various viruses and nasty things that are attacking XP and Vista are attacking old code, and they also work on 2K and stuff. If you're still running 2K or Windows 98, you are so vulnerable, you should plug out your network cable now. And not let the thing anywhere within a network. Because you are just asking to be completely taken over.
Well, that's why my father-in-law left Windows 98 and went to Mac OS X Leopard.
A good choice.
All right. Well, we've gone on long enough. I think I'm going to cut us off here, Bart. I appreciate you making the time for us again today.
I know. It was fun, I have to say, even if we did prattle on perhaps a little long. Maybe you'll edit some of it out.
Maybe. Nah.
Maybe.
That would be weird.
Maybe, yeah. Okay. Until next time. Happy computing.
Well, that's going to wind it up for this hot, sweaty Southern California afternoon. I think I'm going to go find myself a cold drink. Well, hey, don't forget to join us over in Ustream live around 5 o'clock-ish Pacific Standard Time or GMT minus 8. We got a crowd of people in there harassing me who convinced me to do the closing spontaneously here. I'm not doing this from type text. It's very scary, but they made me do it. Anyway, come on in. The water's fine. We're having a lot of fun over there. That's at ustream.tv/nosillacast. Don't forget to follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeet. And, of course, you can always email me at allison@podfeet.com. Or if you're courageous like Jane and want to send in a voice recording, send it on over to nosillacast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.